But why? He repeated, his voice hollow.
Come on, you two, one of the soldiers said. What about the rest of them?
Julian asked as they were walked right past the line waiting to get into the warehouse.
Waiting for blood from one of the black blood banks in Philadelphia, the soldier said,
as if it weren't a completely insane statement. Blood is blood is blood is blood. The only thing that mattered was type. This was an emergency, an utter disaster, and still... this. Calm down, she told herself. Calm down. She crossed her arms over her chest to keep from tearing the world apart around them in a rage of devastation. My city. These people. Etta choked on the bile that rose, and it was only by pressing the back of her hand against her mouth that she kept from throwing up until she was truly as hollow and empty as she felt. What are we doing here? Etta whispered as the man led her and Julian toward the warehouse. We can't stay. You know that. He shook his head, turning back to look at the faces of the people at the door, waiting to get in.
There are open beds. Why are they outside if there are open beds?
They'll be treated when the rest of the staff from Kenny Hospital arrive, the medic said, speaking slowly, as if Julian were a child. This way.
The medic relinquished them to a bleary-eyed doctor, who ushered them over to sit on a cot. The man began to examine the cuts and burns on Etta's arms and hands without so much as a word. A nurse with strawberry blonde hair eventually wandered over with a pail of water and a rag. Julian stared at the man two cots over, quietly weeping into his hat.
"Let me help you there, sugar," the nurse said, and cleaned away the grime and blood Etta had been carrying with her since St. Petersburg. "It's all right to cry. It's better if you do."
"I can't." Something cold had locked around her core, so that she didn't even register the doctor stitching a particularly bad cut without anesthesia. She didn't register Julian scooting to the edge of the cot so that the nurse could lift Etta's legs up, laying her out on the cot. Etta watched in some strange state between sleeping and wakefulness as the doctors, nurses, servicemen, and families of the injured moved between the cots and curtains that divided the enormous space into makeshift rooms.
"Will you stop with this?"
A nearby voice was rising, flustered.
"I don't need to be examined."
"Madam, you do. If you let me continue, I won't be but a moment."
"Can you not understand me?"
the woman said, her voice dripping with a venomous mix of fear and tension.
"I don't want you to touch me."
Etta opened her eyes, craning her neck to see what was happening. The doctor who had stitched her up went right to the other, badgered doctor's side. A black doctor.
"I'll finish here, Stevens," the other man said. "The next shift will start soon. I'm sure they need your assistance more outside."
"Why?"
Julian had been so quiet she'd assumed he'd gone and wandered off.
"Why are there empty beds when there are people outside?"
He wasn't speaking to the doctors, he wasn't speaking to the nurses or the patients, or any one person in particular. There was a manic edge to his tone that drew eyes, nervous glances.
"I want you to tell me why."
"The same reason,"
Etta murmured. "You never truly trained your half-brother. The same reason he had to sign a contract just to travel. The same reason," she continued. "No one ever acknowledged him as being a member of your family." Julian turned on her.
"That's not true. That's not. You have no idea."
She wondered if his privilege had made him blind to others' suffering in his travels, or if maybe it took something of this magnitude to shatter that shield of self-righteousness that being white and male and wealthy had always provided him with. Etta didn't doubt for a second that, as the heir, he might have been protected from harsher years so as to keep him alive. But she also didn't doubt that Julian had never been able to see further than a foot in front of him when it came to other people. Or maybe he'd treated traveling as all of the other Ironwoods seemed to. They disconnected themselves from decency time and time again to play the parts each era demanded of them. They had seen so much, they must have become desensitized to it. The way she could watch a film, see characters suffer,
but never fully invest in their lives because of the emotional distance. Because it never truly felt real. Not in a visceral way. This kind of destruction was what traveling did to people. Not the travelers themselves, but their victims. The common people who could not feel the sands of history shifting around them before they were smothered. Julian's hands were limp at his side, turned slightly toward the room, as if he could weigh the odds of life or death for each person stretched out on a cot. He had closed his eyes. His breathing was shallow. His face screwed up. Powerless. "Remember this," she told him. "How you feel right now." What it felt like to move through the world without power, at the mercy of things bigger than you. Unable, even if just for an hour, to control one's life. How Nicholas had felt for years, before he'd taken all of that strength she loved so much about him and pulled himself up, out, back to the sea. Etta turned her face against the rough fabric of the cot, and focused on nothing beyond her own breathing, fighting back the sweep of shame and anger. "I have to finish this." A single man, on Ironwood's orders, had set this disaster in motion. The blast from the explosion hadn't just killed the Tsar. Its effects had rippled out, exactly as Henry had said, cutting through millions upon millions of innocent lives. For the first time in her life, Etta felt lethal. "We need to leave," she told Julian. "We have to find your grandfather. He has the astrolabe. We can still fix this." Julian shook his head, rubbing his hands over his face.
"I can't go back. I can't."
"The survivor rosters have gone up," she heard a soft voice say. "I'll take you to them, if you'd like. They only account for this field hospital. We should have others by the evening."
Out of the corner of her eye, she saw a nurse leading Julian toward the entrance, where a man was hammering up handwritten lists on large sheets of butcher paper. Those who could rise from their cots did so, swarming that small space. The line outside began to push forward as well, surging toward the sheets in a tangle of arms and legs, until everyone was nearly climbing over each other to get a better look. By the time she saw Julian again, almost 20 minutes later, the same nurse was by his side, leading him toward an area in the far back of the warehouse that had been sectioned off by sterile white curtains. Etta pushed herself up and forward, bracing herself for this next hit. Either his old nanny was alive, or he was being drawn back to identify a body. She caught the tail end of the nurse's instructions as she came up behind Julian. "Need to wear a mask and try not to touch her. The burns are exceedingly painful."
"I understand," Julian said,
accepting both gloves and a face mask from the young woman. Her tidy uniform seemed at odds with the barely managed chaos of the place. She cast them both a sympathetic look before falling back. Etta accepted her own set and pulled them on. She survived. What a small, precious miracle.
"They say she doesn't have long,"
Julian told her, with an odd, forced lightness. Etta knew this feeling, too, of overcompensating to rise above the pain in order to function.
"The air way out in Brooklyn was so hot it damaged her lungs."
Etta put a hand on his arm. "I'm so sorry." He lifted a shoulder in a shrug.
"I'd like to ask her a few things, if she can answer. But mostly, I think I..."
Julian never finished his thought. He took a deep breath, smoothed his hair back, and stepped through the curtain. Inside, about a dozen or so beds were arranged in a U-shape around a central station, where two nurses were cutting bandages and measuring out medicine. The lights from the lanterns were kept dim, but the shadows didn't hide the heavily bandaged figures on each of the beds, the blistered patches of exposed, unnaturally gleaming skin. Julian paced toward the far right end, counting under his breath. Finally he found the one he was looking for, and Etta saw him straighten to his full height as he moved to the small wooden stool beside the cot. He moved the basin of water onto the floor and reached for the hand of the woman on the bed. Etta hung back, unsure whether or not she was meant to be listening or watching.
The woman seemed less bandaged than the others, but wore a bulky oxygen mask. Her face was as pink as the inside of a seashell, and her eyebrows were entirely gone, as were patches of her gray hair. With the utmost care, Julian stroked the back of her hand, careful to avoid the IV line. Within a moment, the woman turned her head toward him, her eyelids inching open. Etta knew the precise moment she saw him and made the connection, because her free hand floated up to pull down her oxygen mask, and those same blue eyes went wide.
"You're..."
"Hello, Nan,"
Julian said, his voice painfully light.
"Gave me a bit of hell trying to track you down in this mess."
Her mouth moved, but it was a long while before words emerged.
I thought I might have passed, but you're not you, not from before."
Etta wasn't sure what she was asking exactly. Julian just responded with one of his infuriating shrugs.
"Before I supposedly plummeted to my untimely death. It's all right. It was only a bit of play. I never did go splat. You know how I love my games."
Even in her condition, the woman, a guardian, knew to be wary of revealing his fate to a traveler, however false a fate it might have been. She blinked almost owlishly at him.
I thought so. You've the look of a man now, though you've grown so well."
As if the whole scene wasn't awful enough, the woman began to cry. Etta began the slow process of backing away without being noticed.
"I'd always hoped to see you one last time, that you'd come to visit me when I was older, so I could see you smile again."
Etta's heart stretched to the point of ripping at the unbridled emotion in the old woman's voice.
"A fair bet that. You've always known, Nan, there's no getting rid of me," Julian told her. "What did you say? Luck of the devil, lives of a cat. I'm only sorry I didn't come sooner."
The eyebrows had been singed from her face, but Etta imagined them lifting at that, just by the way her eyes took on a sudden glint.
"Thank the good Lord you didn't, or else you'd be
dead, dying, incinerated, gone." Etta's stomach turned and she looked away toward the heavy, dark curtain covering the shattered window. The movement must have finally caught the old woman's attention, because Etta felt the pressure of her gaze like a chain jerking her head up.
"My God! Rose!"
Etta jumped at the viciousness of the woman's tone, less amused now to see yet another person all but cross themselves at a reminder of her mother.
"No, Nan,"
Julian said, pressing her gently down onto the bed.
"This is her daughter, Etta. This is the great Octavia Ironwood."
This didn't seem to improve the woman's opinion in the slightest. Her breathing had become labored, to the point where even Julian shot a panicked look at a nearby oxygen tank. Etta took another step back, wondering if she should leave. Julian's old nanny was so fragile right now, any sort of disturbance seemed capable of shattering what strength she had left.
"I never thought I'd see you with the likes of Linden, and her daughter no less."
The woman coughed, hacking up something wet from her lungs. Julian's face softened. He reached for a rag and a bowl of warm water from the nearby stand, and dabbed the blood from the corner of her lips.
"Don't bother yourself."
"It's no bother at all," he told her. "Just returning the favor for all the times you did it for me as a little prat."
"You were never a prat,"
Octavia told him, her voice severe despite the whistle of air in and out of her chest.
"You were trying, you tested, but you were never..."
She cut her eyes at Etta.
"Stupid."
That one stung, Etta had to admit. Initially, hearing things like that had made Etta think of her mother like one of the paintings Rose restored at the Met, its true image obscured by layers of age and grime. Now she wore the truth like a badge of shame.
You tried your best raising me, Julian was saying. But you know me. All style, no sense. I was bound to run with a rougher set sooner or later.
The burned half of the woman's face pulled into an agonizing smile. Etta couldn't tell the difference between her choking and laughter.
You're a little love, she informed him. I might like you even better if you could find me a drink of the good stuff.
I'll bring you a whole bottle of scotch, he vowed. If I have to go to Scotland and bring it back, still cold from the distillery.
Tell me what's happened, she said. This wasn't what was meant to be.
Julian began to explain what had happened, quietly, quickly.
There's a lot to be said about Cyrus Ironwood, Octavia began. There's much to be ashamed of. How he treats his own family, for one. He was so hard on you, for not being what he meant you to be, for not fixing your father.
Etta's hands curled around her biceps, squeezing the muscles. Nicholas and Julian's father, Augustus, had been a vile piece of work. Etta had to wonder if he was what Cyrus had meant for Julian to be. The shadow that passed over Julian's face lifted again as the woman's eyes flickered over to him, then to the room's other sleeping occupants. She spoke so softly, Etta had to move closer to her bed to hear.
There is madness in him. Oh, don't look so surprised. Those of us closest to him have watched him step closer, closer to the fire. But he did create a world better than what had come before. None of this should have happened. But Rose Linden, she and her outcasts could never accept it.
This wasn't part of the original timeline, Julian clarified, just as softly.
I didn't think so, but I couldn't be sure. There were so many changes when Grandfather went to war with the families.
No, Octavia said.
I wouldn't have stayed. I wouldn't have let children, let anyone die. I wouldn't have let this happen.
Etta's heart froze in her chest, seizing painfully. If Octavia thought, believed that she could have prevented this, or at least saved herself, then that meant she had it wrong. Etta had assumed that guardians, unlike travelers, wouldn't be able to recognize when the timeline shifted, that they would simply be carried forward, their lives and memories adjusted, blissfully unaware that their lives had never been different. But that wasn't the case at all. The Ironwood Guardians, in service to the old man, would know how things were meant to play out. If they survived the changes, they would know the timeline had been altered, and live out its consequences. Etta was almost breathless with the unspeakable cruelty of it. These people were born into this hidden world, yet were as much at its mercy as a normal man or woman. Only they would know when something was lost, and when there was a reason to be afraid.
I know, Nan, Julian said, cupping her hand between his. You would have saved the whole damn city if you knew.
You didn't know either, so why come?
Octavia asked, turning her head to better look at him.
Because I needed to find out a few things, Julian said, lying just a little. And you're the only person I trust.
Another painful smile as her burned skin pulled beneath her bandages.
Tell me. But she goes.
Nan, Julian cajoled. Ed is not like her mother. She wasn't even told she was one of us until last month. If you hold her mother against her, you'll have to hold my father against me.
Her mother was the reason for your father's change, for his cruelty. She created it in him. Let's not.
Julian cut her off, then cringed. She didn't make him who he was, She only released what was already inside of him, waiting to be let out. Let's just... I only meant that we're trying to find out what's been happening with the family. Grandfather has been trying to track down his old obsession again, and now we need to find him. The candlelight drew deep shadows across Julian's face as he leaned forward, searching Octavia's face. He shifted uncomfortably, and the creaking of the chair cut through the murmur of life and death in the makeshift ward. She won't talk until I leave, Etta realized. But she wasn't about to step outside and rely solely on Julian relaying the complete picture to her. Easy, Nan, Julian said. This one's all right. I've edited her myself, otherwise I wouldn't have brought her to you. She clearly had some doubts about his judgment, but let this pass. Be careful, won't you? He's been traveling again, came here only days ago, called a family meeting. Don't let him find you, Octavia said, fixing her gaze back on Julian. Him, Julian repeated. Grandpops? Why? The old man moves once every 2 decades at best. If I tell you... Octavia blew out a long, wheezing sigh. What trouble will you find yourself in? The good kind, Julian promised her. The kind that makes you proud of me, even as you put me in the naughty corner. The sound that came out of her must have been a laugh, though it was painful to hear. There's an auction came through the family lines. He came to take the gold from his vault here, buy an auction, Julian repeated, glancing at Etta. Did he say what for? Is there anything else he could want so desperately? The astrolabe. He doesn't already have it, Etta asked. Who had taken it from Kadir in the palace then? Julian must have had a similar thought, but arrived at an actual guess. The Belladonna. I should have known that blasted thing would turn up with her. She must have sent one of her minions to steal it, or one of Grandpop's men went rogue and brought it to her for a fee. Do you know the location of the auction? The year? Octavia shook her head, and Etta felt herself deflate. The old woman grabbed Julian's hand, holding him in place. Leave. Go back. As far back as you can. I've got a few things to do first, he told her. But I will. In time. No, Julian, the shadows, the guardians hear whispers of such things. Murders. Shadows? Julian's brow creased. Are you trying to be funny with me, Nan? Despite her condition, she leveled him with a look perfected by years as a nanny. You also told me my hair was going to fall out if I didn't stop eating sweets. So forgive me if I doubt the story about the creatures who snatch naughty traveler children in the night. What are you talking about? Etta asked, looking between them. You know, the one your mother gently traumatized you with from a young age. About people who live in shadows and steal little traveler children who don't follow the rules. He rubbed at the stubble on his chin, and Etta wondered why everything he ever did made it seem like he was posing. Huh. You don't know. Oh, right. Your terror of a mother kept everything secret, etc. I have to say, this is the first time I've been jealous of you. From the shadows they come. It was only because he had mentioned her mother. It was only because the memory of the Winter Palace was still so close to surface, blooming with renewed pain every few minutes. It was only because of those things that Rose's words circled back to her then, and tentatively linked with what Julian said. You can say if I'm telling it wrong, he told Octavia. But there's this old story about a group that lives in the shadows and takes traveler children who stray from their families. I always thought it was made up to explain how kids got left behind in time periods, or were orphaned. Is that not the case? Killers? Octavia let out a brutal cough, bringing blood to her lips. Julian leaned forward, gently dabbing them with the wet cloth.
"Easy now," he told her. "Murderers, the whole lot of them," Octavia said. "We knew of them. Cyrus, he wants the same thing that they do. Destroyed all records of them. Never wanted anyone to know about them. Otherwise they'd be too frightened to help him search for it."
"It? The astrolabe?" "You don't know what's coming, what's been chasing me for years," her mother had said. "I've kept them off your trail for weeks, from the moment you were taken, but the shadows..." But the shadows. What had Henry told her about Rose's delusions? That she'd become afraid of the darkness? That the delusion of the radiant man who'd haunted her had sent shadows out after her? "What do they look like?" she asked. Rose's attention in the palace had been drawn away by attackers in black. She'd assumed they were Ironwoods, even palace guards, but... Her mind was moving too quickly, strumming through possibilities. There was one more piece to this, something that would weave the truth together. It couldn't be as simple as... No, it wasn't. Henry wasn't wrong. Her mother needed help. She was a murderer who'd killed a member of her own family, her best and only friend.
"Don't... No," Octavia said. "I don't... Just stay away."
"All right. It's all right,"
Julian said, glancing at Etta. "But the shadows. What's been chasing me for years?" Octavia's chest began to rise and fall, fluttering shallowly. When the old woman turned to him again, it was with a wide-eyed desperation, with wretched, gasping breaths. Julian stood from his stool, and Etta thought for one infuriating second that he was about to bolt for the exit. But he only slipped that same tattered notebook out of the fold of his clothing. He retrieved the stubby pencil secured to the back cover with string. The leather was so soft, the journal fell open on the bed, revealing an unfinished sketch of a street. He's an artist. Etta had forgotten that somehow. Or maybe she'd just never been willing to see him as anything other than a coward and a flirt. Because it would have been another complication when her entire world had become a series of them. If he had been one of her mother's paintings, one of those at the Met she had worked so hard to restore, peeling back layers of age and patches, Etta wondered how bright his colors might be beneath.
"Do you remember the old house, Nan? The one we lived in just off the park, up on 60th?
He asked her. His right hand held hers, but his left was already sketching on a blank page.
With the
columns and marble and carriage entry," he continued softly.
"Our little palace. Remember how I slid down the banister and cracked my head on the ground?"
She nodded.
"Blood. Amelia. Fainting. Butler moaning about... The damned vase."
"That's what you remember," he told her. "What I remember is this."
He held up the rough sketch for her to see, but the cover blocked it from Etta's sight. It wasn't meant for her anyway.
"I remember you scooping me up, holding me, telling me that it would be all right, and that you were there and always would be, to take care of me," Julian whispered.
Octavia touched the page with her finger.
"Beautiful."
"That's right. I had a proper, beautiful life thanks to you."
He kissed her bandaged hand.
"And now I'll do the same for you."
"Don't do anything foolish."
"Nan,"
he said, fighting for his smile.
"You can bet on it."
The woman slipped into sleep, and Etta moved away, leaving Julian to keep vigil. Her head felt empty of real thought, even as her heart was clogged with everything threatening to burst out of it. What surprised her most, though, was the jealousy, burning just beneath the pity and fear. He gets to be with her. Julian would be there for Octavia when she died. Etta didn't think she had much time left at all, but she knew with certainty that Julian would not leave her. It was more than she'd been able to give Alice. Henry had stayed with Alice. And who had stayed with Henry? Etta lost track of time, walking between the rows of cots, trying not to notice the new openings in the beds. It didn't feel like nearly enough hours before Julian emerged and came straight toward her, shooting through the rows of the dead and dying like a fiery arrow. He took her arm and drew her forward, stopping only long enough to lift a pile of plain gray trousers and white shirts, the same thing the nurses had changed most of the wounded into.
"Here,"
he said, motioning her towards the screen. "Change here." Etta slipped behind it, watching his silhouette move against the white fabric, pacing. "What happened?" She let her dress fall to the ground and tugged on the soft, oversized clothing.
"Nan's finally at peace,"
he told her quietly, coming closer.
"I was waiting for it, for the timeline to shift, to be flung out of here, but it never came. And then I tried to remember. I tried to remember if any change had ever been caused by a guardian dying, or if time just sees them the way Grandfather does. Disposable. And? And I couldn't. I couldn't. It feels like it should have shifted the whole world. A traveler can do one thing outside of his time, and the whole of it can shift. I don't like that. That it makes it seem like she wasn't important."
He was talking quickly, almost too quickly for Etta's tired mind to keep up with.
"All done?"
Etta stepped out from behind the screen and let him pass her to start changing. "Julian," she said gently, "are you all right? Take a minute if you have to."
"I don't think we have a minute, do you?"
he said.
"There's an Ironwood message drop in this year, just a ways upstate. The Belladonna will have flooded the drops with invitations to the auction, just to get as many bidders as possible. We can start looking there."
"Who is the Belladonna?" Etta asked.
"She's a collector and an agent of sale for rare artifacts," he said, pulling his new shirt over his head. "There's going to be a buy-in amount of gold we'll need to provide, but the bidding is done by submitting offers of secrets and favors. We just need to get inside, and then we can do whatever it is you think we're supposed to be doing."
"Destroying the astrolabe," Etta said. Julian leaned out from behind the screen.
"Destroying it? What good is that going to accomplish? Shouldn't we use it to try to save these people?"
One of the first things she'd learned about life as a traveler was that you couldn't save the dead, not without consequences. But whatever fate the original timeline had intended for these people, this wasn't it. "It'll reset everything," she explained. "Bring it back to the original timeline, the one we knew. It'll be gone." Julian turned away from surveying the cots, the weeping men and women by the survivor boards, and glanced back at her over his shoulder.
"Then let's go."
Vatican City, 1499. 24. Nicholas felt himself nod. Nod as if to say, "Yes, I expected this. I accept this." Because in truth, some part of him had. This was fate's delight, to give him what he desired, or what he had not known he desired, only to viciously snatch it back again, just when it seemed as if he might seize it.
"What?"
he heard Sophia say.
"How?" "A notice went out to all of the travelers and guardians," Lehman said, struggling with each word, like her throat threatened to choke on them.
She dug into her bag, retrieving a small slip of paper, and passed it to Sophia.
"Henry Hemlock demands satisfaction from Cyrus Ironwood for the unspeakably cruel murder of his daughter, Henrietta, who has lately passed into eternity from wounds sustained from an attack by his guardians, while she was already weakened. Oh my God! Date and place of death is listed as October 2nd, 1905, Texas."
Something like bile or fire was rising up his throat. He couldn't speak. Nicholas felt parts of himself begin to close off, as if to deny entry again to that now familiar pain. I wasn't fast enough. I couldn't reach you. I only wanted to save you. The cathedral of hope in his heart, which he'd carefully crafted each day since he and Etta had been torn apart, burned down to its foundations of desperation and despair. Oh, God. Oh, God.
Carter, Lee Min said. I think perhaps we should continue through the passage, find a place to sit, and take some water, yes?
He shook his head, straining to get away from her. He began to stalk down the hall again, reaching for doors, tearing them open. It couldn't be right. Her earring was here. Hemlock must have been mistaken. He would have felt it, wouldn't he? He would have felt the world crash down upon itself if she'd passed on. The bell of his spirit would have been silenced. She had been dead nearly the whole time he'd been searching for her. He had been chasing a ghost. A memory. No. Sophia stood there watching him, letting the death notice slip from her fingers. Lehman finally caught his arm, and this time she didn't let him shake her off.
I know what it is you think, but consider the possibilities.
They said she died in Texas, 2 days after she disappeared. But then how was her earring here? He demanded.
Lehman's response was as infuriatingly calm as always.
Someone might have taken the earring from her, or traded her for it. Or this earring, this version of it, might be from a past time in her mother's life, before she ever gave them to her daughter. It might have been you, in the future, who returned here.
Her words dripped through him one by one, poisoning that last small hope moving beneath his skin. He did not know Etta's father from Adam, but he knew Lee Min now. He trusted Lee Min. His stomach rioted. He raised his hand, pressing his fist against his mouth. Time travel. Bloody impossible, bloody unmerciful, bloody befuddling time travel. Why had he ever accepted Ironwood's job? Why hadn't he just listened to Hall when he'd advised Nicholas to steer as far away from the family as he was able? Why hadn't the sea been enough for him? He never should have allowed himself to be drawn back into this web. It was only ever going to catch him, wrap around his throat until it strangled him. But it wouldn't have stopped Ironwood. He still would have stolen Etta out of her time. She would have been set on the search alone. Nothing and no one was ever going to stop Ironwood until he had the astrolabe, and everything he'd ever desired.
"She's not here," he rasped out,
trying to grasp the meaning of those words. Lehman nodded.
"She," Nicholas forced himself to say, "was most likely never here at all."
Sophia looked away. Pride warred with humiliation in him, before both were sunk by a devastation that left him breathless. It stole the years of experience he'd collected in stealing himself to the world, took even that small measure of dignity he'd eked out from his existence. And what was left inside him was that same pain he'd felt as a child, alone in the dark cupboard of the Ironwood House in New York, waiting for some signal of when he was allowed to step outside of it.
"Thank you," he told Lee Min. "I apologize. I am not myself. I do believe..."
"Will you find her mother, then, to tell her?" Lee Min asked. "This Rose Linden?"
"No. I am almost certain she already knows," Nicholas said.
Perhaps that was, in the end, why she had never come.
"If she'd taken her revenge, we'd know by now," Sophia said. "That bit of news would travel quickly in our circle."
A light shone down from the hallway, marking the path of someone coming toward them. Sophia took his limp arm and pulled him toward the door they had stopped outside of. On instinct, he tried to drag his feet, as if another search might turn up a different result. Lee Min lifted a candle from the wall and opened the door, then latched it behind them. Nicholas knew the Pieta the moment he saw it, though it caught him off guard to find it in such a small side chapel. The Carrara marble was flawless, glowing like warm moonlight. The Virgin Mary, her face too young to be holding the body of an adult son, was a mysterious contradiction of sweetness and grief. Love, sacrifice, release, an endless, eternal story. No, this traveler war wasn't anything so pure. This was a story of revenge, of families who'd warred so long that no one could remember who'd instigated the fights in the first place. An Ironwood had killed Lindens, and a Linden had caused the death of Ironwood heirs. And so the Ironwoods claimed the life of the Linden heir. The awful symmetry of it all did not stop with only those two families. There must have been hundreds, thousands of stories like it over the years. It was a cycle that he himself had been caught in. Staring at the woman's serene stone face, with Sophia and Li Min whispering behind him, Nicholas felt as still and quiet as if he'd become the eye of a hurricane. In the candlelight it was so very easy to imagine Mrs. Hall's face, warmed by the fireplace as she read to him and Chase from the Bible, as she did every night. Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. But God had had his chance to pass judgment on the evil that lived in Cyrus Ironwood's heart, and had failed to act. Nicholas, for the first time in his life, questioned his judgment, because it was neither true nor righteous nor acceptable. It's left to me.
I require a path, he said, back to 1776.
Li Min and Sophia ceased their conversation. Look, Carter, Sophia began. I know how you feel.
Do you know? He said coldly. How would you feel, then, to know that Julian survived his fall and wasn't ever lost to you or any of us?
He was surprised how easily the words flowed out of him after being held inside for so long. Some part of him recognized how unfeeling it was to drop it on Sophia's head like an anchor. But Nicholas found himself beyond caring. If anything, he felt his hurt should be catching. There was more than enough to be shared by the parties present. Sophia turned toward him, her lips parting.
I was mistaken in how I interpreted that moment on the cliff. Rose Linden was the one to correct my misunderstanding. He was orphaned by a timeline shift, and never returned to us. I apologize for not telling you sooner, he said,
his bloody guilt getting the better of him, her single dark eye burning with the intensity of its gaze.
Initially, before you told me the truth of your heart, I thought if you knew he might be alive, you'd want to find him and restore your engagement. Find forgiveness with Ironwood. And then it was only a matter of not wanting you to be distracted.
That earned him a hard fist to the cheek, blowing him sideways.
What I always wanted was respect, she growled out. Shame on me for thinking I might have found some of that in your regard. Shame on me for ever being so stupid.
You're not.
I nearly got myself killed helping you. Not because I owe it to you, but because I want to find the men who attacked me. I want to take from them what they took from me, and even our score. I want Grandfather's rule to crumble. I want to watch it pulverize to dust, and see everything he loves ripped away from him, Sophia seethed. Why would I ever search out someone who abandoned me? Someone who had no regard for any of us? Who ran because he's too much of a damn coward to stand up to his family?
I know that now, he said. I'm sorry, but it felt like too much of a risk. I
needed to use me, Sophia said. To go after your person, to achieve your ends. My desire was to be heir, which might have gotten me treated like a whole person, not fodder for marriage. Julian was my friend. I care about him. But I decided in that desert, before you ever found me, that what I really wanted was the freedom to do as I pleased, with whomever I pleased. I wanted to move as freely as the wind, and not be called back into port against my will. That is power. Do you understand?
He nodded, his throat tight.
Beyond measure.
Their conversation had drawn the attention of someone outside the chapel. There was a pounding on the door, a muffled voice that called out a question.
Li Min whirled back toward Nicholas. "If you mean to complete the Belladonna's task," she said, "then I will be your guide."
"No."
It was a terrible thing, and he wanted them far from it.
"I need to see this through myself."
She shook her head. "You will need someone to dig your grave, for even if you finish with the old man, the journey to that moment will end you." Sophia let out a harsh breath, crossing her arms.
"This is my path now," he told her, using his left hand to lift his right, to show her the ring. "I am dead regardless. If I don't kill him, the poison will take me. If I'm not quick enough arriving there, the poison will take me. If I succeed, at least there will be one fewer evil in the world. At least this way I might yet live long enough to return to Hall and die at sea."
The pounding on the door grew louder, as if someone was throwing their weight against it. "You're not leaving us behind to sweep up your mess after you," Sophia snarled, pulling him toward the shivering air of the passage. "You just better pray I don't kill you first myself." They passed through a series of passages cobbled together from their combined memories, leading at various points to a rather treacherous section of the Australian outback, a pristine glacier, and the most dire year of the Middle Ages that Austria had to offer, with countless small, insignificant connections between each. When they encountered anyone, he and Li Min shrouded themselves, letting Sophia speak in the rare instances speaking was necessary. Nicholas wondered several times over the course of this journey if a man could feel so hollow as to become invisible, or if people only saw what they expected to see, which, in the case of their situation, was not a Chinese woman or a black man. In any case, the silence suited him well enough. It was easier to keep his mind still and focused on the days ticking down. On the night of the 16th, a few miles from the last passage on the outskirts of Mexico City, Nicholas began to sense Li Min and Sophia slowing, eating away at his own pace. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw the young women exchange a look. Not wanting to confront it, he dug his heels into his horse's side to urge it forward. Before the mare could work herself back up to a gallop, a small hand lashed out and ripped the reins from his hands.
"What the devil?"
"You will do what you have now attempted 3 times. You will ride that animal until it collapses and dies beneath you," Li Min told him sternly, pulling the reins further out of his reach. "I do not intend to share my horse. Do you, Sophia?"
"Certainly not."
"I have not," he began.
"We haven't slept in 2 days, Carter," Sophia interrupted.
"Surely not."
"We stopped a night ago."
"No, that was Austria, that scenic little spot you picked by the rancid moat. I'm sure one of us picked up the Black Death as a parting gift."
Christ, she was right.
"Let's move off the road. Camp for a few hours," Li Min suggested.
Revolt surged inside of him, and must have been clear from his expression, because Sophia turned her horse and led them off the worn road and onto the lush green earth. Somehow Nicholas had always pictured this part of the world as entirely desert. But even this late in the year, there was life and vegetation sweeping up from their valley to the peaks of the mountains around them. He counted the paces under his breath, from the road to where Sophia decided was far enough to drop her saddlebags, and decided it was 200 paces too far. He could go ahead, let them rest and catch up to him later. Before he could devise a course of action, Li Min led his horse forward toward the others and began to unhook its harness. He breathed sharply out of his nose, but finally dismounted.
"I'll hunt."
Shooting something sounded marvelous, now that he had gunpowder again. He could not shoot with his right arm, useless as it was, but he wasn't a terrible shot with his left.
"Li Min is already going," Sophia said, from where she was laying out the bedding.
He turned, then turned again, surprised to find Li Min's small form retreating into the distance.
"You can find the firewood and kindling."
"All right, but I'll cook."
Sophia made a face he didn't understand.
And water.
We're fine for now, she said, tossing away the wide-brimmed hat she'd found abandoned on the road. Go! Before your expression finally does me in. For someone out for cold-blooded revenge, you've got the look of a sad, sorry bastard about you. Somehow he didn't doubt it. Nicholas gave her an ironic little bow, before setting about the task in front of him. Li Min had not returned by the time he had started the fire, and brought the little pot they'd acquired to boil. Rather than try to talk to the stone-faced Sophia, Nicholas slid his right arm from the sling Li Min had knotted for him, and lay down with his back to the fire. His eyes felt too gritty to shut, but he tried. He tried relaxing his body against the unyielding dirt, and he tried to clear the swirl of dark thoughts rising up inside of him before they pulled him under. One hand dipped inside his loose tunic and around the string of leather. When he felt brave enough, he opened his eyes to study the bead in the image of a man, and at his earring. He was seized by a compulsion he didn't understand. He yanked hard on the cord, trying to rip it off by force, then reached back to fumble with the knot.
By doing that, you'll only feed the fire of regret that burns in you, Li Min said from nearby, having returned from her hunt. Not extinguish it.
His hand relaxed, but didn't fall away. Nicholas shoved himself up off the ground, intent on cooking now that she had returned.
This reminds me of a tale, Li Min said casually, before he could fully stand.
She sat between him and the fire, casting a long shadow over him.
Would you care to hear it?
Not precisely, but he grunted, knowing she would tell it regardless.
It goes as follows. Many, many years ago, Emperor Yan had a daughter, Nua. She was as lovely and elegant as a crane, but stubborn as an ox. More than anything, she loved to swim, and often chose the East Sea for its wild beauty. I think you understand the impulse, no?
He only seemed to be capable of grunting. His chest was too tight to manage actual words.
But tragedy struck. One day while swimming, she drowned. Her will, however, was strong, and she would not give in, not completely. She broke the surface of the water and transformed into a Jingwei bird. Have you seen one? They are quite striking. A gray beak, red claws? Well, regardless, she sought out her vengeance for drowning. Every day she flew to gather stones and sticks from the western mountains and dropped them into the East Sea. Her desire was to fill it, to prevent others from drowning. She never rested in her task. She continues to this day.
He turned over fully, when it was clear her story was at an end.
Then it was an impossible task. What meaning am I supposed to derive from this?
Li Min shrugged.
You may make anything of it you wish, Carter. The purpose of that tale was to distract you long enough for dinner to be served, and that has not been an impossible task after all.
Nicholas sat up straight, outrage burning through the gray haze around his mind.
I told you I would do it!
What good was he if he couldn't contribute his share of work?
This may come as a surprise to you, but I don't actually prefer my meat shriveled and charred so far beyond recognition I mistake it for old firewood, Sophia said, turning the skinned rabbits over on the spit.
That's how you know it's cooked!
Both women gave him their variations of a pitying look. His stomach rumbling, he took his share of the meat with a reluctance that could only come from pride. When he finished, he accepted Li Min's suggestion that he rest first and take the later watch. On his bedding once more, he turned his back to the fire, resting his head on his arm and staring out at the dark mountains. He drifted to sleep, ignoring the warm grip of the gold band around his small finger. A clang cut through the darkness, followed quickly by another.
Better, better, but do not lean in so much as you thrust. No! To your left. Yes.
Nicholas fumbled his way back to awareness, unsure whether he was hearing Lehman's voice or dreaming it. Turning onto his back, he looked toward the fire, watching his two slight, shadowy figures sparred with swords.
"It's useless," Sophia said. "I'll never get it right. Not really."
"You've done it perfectly. As well as you have done everything else I've shown you tonight," Li Min said, a smile in her voice. "You move through the world like a cat, all silk and sinew. Soon you'll be better than me, and then I'll really need to watch my gold."
"No chance of that," Sophia said after a moment. Frustration edged into the words.
"You are a superb fighter," Li Min said, settling on the ground and resting her sword across her legs.
After a moment, Sophia lowered herself to her knees, placing her weapon down on a nearby blanket.
"It's just, I used to be better, before this."
She gestured absently to her eye patch.
"Ah," Li Min said.
"The world looks different," Sophia said. "At first I thought it was only my imagination, self-pity, what have you. But the truth is the shadows and highlights have peeled back. Colors seem flat, and my perception of how near or far something is from me is occasionally a little off. But the biggest problem is the blind spot."
He closed his eyes, sighing. He'd expected as much, and felt rightly worse for not trying to help her overcome it in any way he could. Whether or not she would have accepted his help was debatable, but he should have tried, damn it.
"Stand up. I'll show you something," Li Min said.
There was a shuffle of fabric and feet in the dirt as Sophia did.
"Assume your usual stance."
When Sophia slid her left leg back, angling her right half forward, Li Min clucked her tongue and reversed it, her fingers gliding along Sophia's skin, clasping, just for a moment, around her small wrist.
"Fighting is all angles, yes? Altering your stance so your good eye is set back might help. However, I think you feel most comfortable switching back and forth quickly, like this."
Li Min danced from side to side, quick and light on her feet as she circled Sophia, constantly adjusting her stance so her left eye, which she had to shut to demonstrate this to Sophia, was never in front for long.
"It looks like you're dancing," Sophia said, voicing Nicholas's own awe.
After a moment, she attempted to replicate the movement. Her face fell at her initial clumsiness, but soon she seemed to match Li Min step for step. And she was smiling.
"It feels a little ridiculous," Sophia admitted, as they returned to the blanket and relinquished her blade again. "You've not had time to become used to it," Li Min said, placing his soft hand on Sophia's wrist. "It will get better with time. You should know that there are countless stories of warriors who've borne a similar injury and overcome it. One general from my land was said to have been shot in the eye with an arrow. Rather than crumble, he pulled the arrow out and ate the eye off it."
"That's disgusting, even for me," Sophia said, laughing. "And you know it's far more likely he did crumble and scream like a child. But who can blame him?" "There is no doubt in my mind about that," Li Min said,
and for a while they seemed content to play a game of trying to avoid the other catching their gaze. The slow drift of fingers across the blanket, easing closer and closer with each soft breath. He was about to close his eyes and turn again to give them privacy, when Li Min said,
"There is still such a shadow on your face. What is troubling you?"
Rather than pull away, Sophia slid her hand lightly up along the other girl's arm, drawing her loose sleeve up to touch her pale skin. She leaned forward, so close that, for a moment, Nicholas was sure she might rest her forehead against Li Min's shoulder.
"Did you mean what you said about seeking revenge? That there's no way to survive it?"
A deep sigh.
"After I escaped the shadows, I wanted nothing more than to grow strong enough to return and butcher them, as they had done my mother and my sister. It was enough to sustain me for years. I fed on the anger, bathed in the fury, prayed with malice. But one morning, A woman on my ship asked me what I would make of my life after